Thank you, Steve. Well, good morning, everybody. Show of hands as we're getting started. How many of you guys have ever participated or run in a triathlon? Show of hands, anybody? A few. Awesome. It used to be my hobby for about 7 or 8 years. I committed myself at least once a summer, if not 2 or 3 times a summer, to figuring out a race and then training for it and doing it. The first ever triathlon that I ran was a sprint. There's sort of 4 categories of triathlon. The first is the easiest, the sprint, and then the next is Olympic, and then half Ironman, and then Ironman. So my first ever was one called the Seabright Sprint. It was a quarter mile swim, 12 miles on the bike, and then a 3.1 mile run to finish. Now, by all accounts, my very first race went reasonably well. I didn't win anything. I wasn't expecting to win anything. I basically just wanted to finish. But I finished probably somewhere in the middle. I think I beat about as many people as beat me. And for me, first time around, I was happy with that. And so after reflecting on and thinking about how good that felt, I thought, you know what, the next time I do this, I want to challenge myself rather than run a couple more sprints and get used to that. I want to do the Olympic, which was the next level up. So if you take what I had there, the next level is you swim a mile, you ride 25 on the bike, and then you run 6.2. So piece of cake, right? No problem. So I beefed up my training and I worked really hard. And I decided that my second race was going to be a race called Escape from Fort Delaware. So it sounds a whole lot more manlier than the Seabright Sprint, right? So I trained and trained for this Escape from Fort Delaware. And then on Saturday, June 25th, I think it was 2006, I arrived in Delaware City for my first Olympic adventure. Now, to make a long story short, they ferried us out by groups a mile to an island called Peapatch Island. If some of you guys have ever been to Fort Delaware in Delaware City, there's a place called Peapatch Island, which once upon a time housed a Union prison camp during the Civil War. And so as they were taking us out to this place, I noticed that a mile on the water seemed like a whole lot further than a mile on land. And the further we went and the smaller the land got, the more afraid I became because of a couple of reasons. First, I really didn't know how to swim very well. Like, there's a big difference between a quarter mile and a mile if you've never swam the distance between the two. And you can kind of fake a quarter mile, but you really can't fake a mile, especially if there are whitecaps on the water, which there were, because the night before the race was the full moon. And as you know, with the tides coming on the other side of the full moon, it really wreaks havoc on the water. And so as we're moving to Peapatch Island and it's getting further and further, I think to myself, I don't know if I'm gonna be able to do this. I have all these crazy thoughts going through my head as I'm watching the whitecaps, and the ferry that's taking us is rocking. And so I don't know, I'm just getting a little bit nervous that maybe I've bitten off a little more than I can chew, because a mile in the pool is very different than a mile on whitecap river waters. So anyway, we get there, and by the time they release my group to go, they blow the whistle and I start swimming. And I'm swimming and I'm swimming and I'm swimming, but like 5, 6, 7 minutes in, I'm not getting anywhere. I feel like I'm swimming like against a wall. And the problem is, as I am swimming, I only really had learned how to swim turning my head to one side. Ideally, you want to learn how to swim doing both sides, because if you ever run into a situation where the waves are coming over you on one side, you need to be able to do the other. The only problem is I didn't know how to do it. And so every other stroke, water, river water is coming into my mouth, and I am just, it is disgusting. And not only is it bad, I'm now becoming demoralized and afraid that like Pea Patch Island, the distance between Pea Patch Island and basically the mainland isn't reducing in any way. So 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 minutes seemed like an hour, and I'm just not getting there, and I'm struggling. And now I decide I'm going to flip over on my back and think about what my options are, because as many people are making their way to land, I'm not seemingly getting a whole lot closer. And so as I flip over and lay on my back and try to gather myself, it's a beautiful sunny day. I look up into the sky and I just start thinking, I don't want to fail. I work really hard, but I'm not going to make it. And so as I contemplated, do I keep trying? Do I keep trying? Or do I give up? I don't want to fail, but I don't want to die either. And death seems like very imminent as I'm taking more water in. And so I'm thinking, oh, I can't quit. I can't quit. I'm only 10 minutes in. I've worked so hard. I don't want to die. Eventually, as I wrestled through those thoughts, I got to the place where I realized, let me give it just a couple more minutes. So I went back over and started my swimming again. And I just wasn't getting anywhere. So finally, after about like 10, 15 minutes, I signaled the boat to come take me in. And as the boat came and picked me up, I just was so demoralized. And as I got into the boat, there were a whole bunch of other waterlogged swimmers who couldn't make it. And briefly, I felt better, but it didn't take long for me to realize it really wasn't about them. It was about me. Just because they failed and I wasn't in the boat alone didn't make it any better. Like, I really wanted to succeed. I hate failing at stuff. And so as I got in the boat, it took us about 20 minutes to make our way back to land. And we were, of course, all disqualified. So there was no need in running the rest of the race, but I decided to anyway. So I got on my bike and I did my 25 and then I did my run. And part of the reason that I did that, I knew I wasn't going to win the race, but I knew there was an important lesson for me in not giving up. And so as I processed what had happened in the first part of the race, there were things that I could only learn if I would only just continue to do the run. So I say all of that to say that today I want to talk with you about what it feels like when you find yourself in situations where you're in way over your head and it feels like you're going to drown. All of us have been in this season-long COVID place where we found ourselves at various times in over our heads, way beyond what we think that we can deal with. And I want to just drill in this morning into those moments where you just feel like your options are limited. You're in over your head and you don't know what to do. Now, as a bit of background before we jump into the text this morning, if you weren't with us last week, Jesus suffered one of the deepest losses of his life. His cousin and his childhood friend, John the Baptist, was brutally murdered. He was beheaded by King Herod. So when he gets the news, all Jesus wants to do is to be left alone. He wants to just process his grief and think about his loss. He doesn't want company. He just wants to be by himself. So he gets in a boat and he sails to the other side of the lake or the Sea of Galilee. But when he gets there, there are so many people who are just swarming him. They're not thinking about his needs or what he wants. They're thinking about how he can help them with their needs. They're sick, they're blind, they're lame, they're deaf. It's a motley crew of people who've assembled there, and they just want a piece of Jesus. The disciples don't really want them there, and they basically want to tell him to go kick rocks. But Jesus is like, listen, as much as I want to be alone and as much as I need this time, you need to open your eyes and look at what's right in front of you, or you're going to miss this moment. And so he spends the better part of the day healing the people who are there and who are sick. And as the sun begins to set and day turns to night, he realizes that there's this whole group, thousands of people who haven't eaten anything. And so he asks his disciples, hey, what do you say before we call this thing a close for the day? What do you say that we feed these guys? And they're like, what are you, crazy? We don't, look at how many people are here. We don't have enough to feed them. And Jesus is like, well, have you tried? And they're like, try? Why try? We know we don't have enough. And Jesus says to them, rather than start from the place of saying you don't have enough, why don't you just bring me what you have? Rather than quitting before you begin, why don't you just see what you have and bring it to me? And when you bring it to me, I will do great things with it. And so they do. And we don't know how he does this great miracle, but Jesus takes the 5 loaves and the 2 fish. He breaks the bread, he blesses it, and he hands it out. So much so that everyone, not only does everyone have enough to eat, but by the time they finish, he has his disciples take baskets around and pick up the leftovers. And they have 12 baskets full of leftovers. And so as they do that, the lesson that is to be learned here is that you never, if you want to see a miracle materialize in your life, you never quit before you begin. Even if you don't think you have enough, bring what you have and offer it to him and watch what he will do with what you have. So they finish the meal. He teaches the lesson. He sends the crowds into town, and he sends his disciples back into the boat to cross to the other side. And while they go back to the other side, he goes up into the hills to pray and to have the alone time that he needed at the beginning of the day. And that's where the story picks up. So I'm going to ask Bonnie if she would to read. This story comes from Matthew chapter 14, verses 22 to 33. This is where we begin our story.
Immediately after this, Jesus insisted that his disciples get back into the boat and cross to the other side of the lake while he sent the people home. After sending them home, he went up into the hills by himself to pray. Night fell while he was there alone. Meanwhile, the disciples were in trouble far away from the land, for a strong wind had risen and they were fighting heavy waves. About 3 o'clock in the morning, Jesus came toward them walking on the water. When the disciples saw him walking on the water, they were terrified. In fear, they cried out, "It's a ghost!" But Jesus spoke to them at once. "Don't be afraid," he said. "Take courage, I am here." Then Peter called to him, "Lord, if it's really you, tell me to come to you walking on the water." "Yes, come," Jesus said. So Peter went over the side of the boat and walked on the water toward Jesus. But when he saw the strong wind and the waves, he was terrified and began to sink. "Save me, Lord," he shouted. Jesus immediately reached out and grabbed him. "You have so little faith," Jesus said. "Why did you doubt me?" When they climbed back into the boat, the wind stopped. Then the disciples worshiped him. "You really are the Son of God," they exclaimed.
So the first question you just have to ask yourself when you're reading the story is this: why would Jesus send his disciples back into the boat by themselves when he knows a storm is coming? We know he wants some alone time and that he needs it, but why not just send them back into town? Why not send them to a place where they can find shelter from the storm? Why does he send them back out on a boat onto the water? Now, Matthew doesn't tell us, and so we don't really know. We're only left to wonder. And so I wonder if there's a lesson here for his disciples that only a storm can teach them. What if some of the storms of our life are actually necessary? What if they're inevitable? What if there's some storms that we can't avoid? We can't go around. What if there are some storms we just need to go through? And then, what if on the other side of the storm, there's actually something better than what you're leaving on this side? We don't know why he sends them back into the heart of the storm in a boat, but he does. And so as the story continues, the disciples find themselves smack dab in the middle of a storm that threatens to take their very lives. And Jesus is nowhere to be found. The storm is going to batter the disciples and the boat all night long. 7 p.m., 8 p.m., 9 p.m., 10 p.m., 11 p.m., 12 p.m. They're going to move from one day to the next. And as the storm continues, they're going to be incredibly weary. Anybody ever been on a boat in the middle of a storm? Anybody been on a boat in the middle of the storm, in the middle of the night? This is a scary proposition. Jesus is nowhere to be found. The disciples are fighting for their lives. And they're searching, but they can't find him. The disciples, more than anything, just want him to show up and to make it stop. And I would imagine that you've been in this space, if not on a boat in the middle of a storm, that you've been in that space where you just wanted God to show up. You just wanted the pain to stop, the physical, the emotional, the mental. The psychological pain was so great that all you wanted was to stop. But God was nowhere to be found. If you've been in that space, you know how terrifying it is. But then, sometime just before dawn, around 3 a.m., the scriptures say, Jesus comes out and he's walking on the water. Now, this story is familiar to many of us, but like he's walking on the water, and you would think that this would bring some immediate sense of comfort, but it actually freaks them out more than before he arrived, because they don't know that it's him. They actually think that it's a ghost. They think that they're in the land of the dead, that there are these zombies now walking out that seek to, not only is the storm threatening their life, but these ghosts are materializing and they're freaking out. But when Jesus gets close enough, he says what he would oftentimes say to them. He says, "Hey guys, it's me. Don't be afraid." To which they're like, "Seriously, dude? I mean, don't be afraid? It's a little late for that, don't you think? I mean, where have you been? We have been out here forever. Where have you been?" I'm sure some of you know this feeling. Where were you when the rent was due? Where were you when my marriage was falling apart? Where were you when my child was far from home and making choices that actually threatened their very lives? Where were you when the global pandemic hit and so many lives were lost? There's so much fear and so much doubt and darkness that's consuming them. Where were you? Jesus says, "Don't be afraid." And they're like, "You got to be kidding me. Don't be afraid." And there's this interesting thing that happens in this exchange. It's a brief exchange, but as the story unfolds, there's this place where from the corner of the boat, Peter, of course it's Peter, summons what little courage that he has left and says to Jesus, "Lord, is it you? I can't tell if it's you, but if it's you, if it's really you, then you just say the word and I'll come out there and I'll join you." And the others have to just kind of look at him and be like, "What are you talking about?" And Jesus does. He gives him one word. He says, "Come." He calls Peter from the one thing that he's clinging to, from the one thing that represents his zone of comfort. And he calls him out into the middle of the chaos. And if you're Peter, it seemed like the right thing to do, to say, "If it's you, call me." But now he actually has called you. So what do you do? You have to be going back and forth in your mind with all the what ifs, right? I mean, what if I go and I don't make it? But then again, what if I don't go and I just stay here in the boat with the others? What if I go and I make it? What if I fall on my face again and everybody sees the clown that I am? But what if I actually become a hero? What if I step into what seemingly is impossible? There are all these what ifs. And what I've found in my life a lot of times when I start playing the what if game, I tend to focus a lot on the downside of the what if rather than on the upside. The downside of the what if, where I think about all the reasons that I shouldn't, really keep me in the space that I am. It keeps me from moving forward. It's only when I envision the possibilities of the value of taking a step in a new direction that I actually find the courage to do it. There is no miracle without a step out of the boat. There is no miracle without action, without movement, without moving beyond where you are. And so Peter's like, if it's you, then tell me to come and I'll come. And so Jesus calls his bluff and says, come on, Peter, let's go. And so after going through all of his what ifs, he swings his leg out of the boat. And I don't know how terrifying this must have been, because this is in the middle of the night, in the middle of a storm. He's exhausted. And so Jesus doesn't give him instructions on how to transcend the laws of nature. He doesn't say, like, this is how you do it, Peter. This is how I got out to you. Here's some instructions. He just says, come. He just invites him. And Peter's like, I don't know if walking on water is different than walking on land. I'm not sure what I'm supposed to do. But he steps his foot out over the boat and he begins to walk. That same voice that called him to come is now enabling him to do the impossible. And as he puts his foot out of the boat and he begins to walk on the water, I think this point in the story is a time for you and I to think about what it is that God is actually calling us to do these days that simply would be impossible without him. I mean, where is that place where you're wanting to move forward and you're listening for his voice that he's calling you to, that if it isn't for his help, you'll never be able to accomplish it? Where is that space? And if you think long enough and you can't come up with anything, then perhaps these days, maybe you're just playing it too safe. Peter asks for permission to do the impossible. And then Jesus invites him and he goes. He's walking on water in the middle of a storm. It's one thing for Jesus to do this. It's another for Peter. Now, we don't know how long the water walk lasted. Was it 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 steps? We have no idea. But at some point along the way, his excitement, his encouragement, his, I can't believe I'm doing this, turned into looking around at himself and thinking, what am I doing? Now he's out in the middle of it all, and he starts to fixate and focus on what could go wrong. His fears and his doubts began to swallow him, and he begins to sink. And he calls out to Jesus. He doesn't blame him. He doesn't blame him for the silly invitation. How could you possibly invite me to do something that you knew I couldn't do? And he doesn't do what probably I would have done. Because I told you in the very beginning, when I knew I wasn't going to make it, I kept trying anyway. It was futility, but I kept trying to swim. He doesn't try that. He doesn't try to swim back to the boat. He doesn't try to swim to Jesus. This dude's a fisherman. He knows how to deal with the water. He could have made his way back to one or the other, but he doesn't. As he begins to sink, he just cries out to Jesus, and he asks him, save me. And Jesus, the story tells us, is not only close enough to hear him, he's close enough to reach him. And as he reaches him and pulls him up, he asks him a simple question. And he says, oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt me? You just saw me feed thousands and thousands of people with 5 loaves of bread and a couple of fish. You've been walking with me for how long? And you've seen how much you saw me put my hands on people and literally give them their sight back. You saw me restore hearing. You saw me heal those who couldn't walk. You've seen this over and over. Why did you doubt me? I think to myself for a moment, little faith. He's the only one who actually had any faith. Nobody else asked for the invitation to come. I don't see Jesus in this spot blaming Peter. I see him trying to help reframe for Peter the things that he had forgotten. See, because when we're in the middle of a storm, all we tend to focus on is the wind and the waves. All we tend to focus on is the fact that we're getting battered and that we're tired and that we're sinking and that we're failing. It's what we tend to focus on. We can't remember 5 seconds ago when he was taking bread and loaves and multiplying it to feed thousands of people. We can't think of all the times where he's brought us through all of the other storms to get to the space that we are right now. All we can really think about more often than not is the current space we're in. And it causes our vision to become blurred. Sometimes the latest and greatest events of our life cause us to focus at what is at hand more than what has happened all the way along the way, all the times that Jesus has saved and brought us through. Lord, save me. And immediately Jesus reaches out and he grabs Peter. And the only way he can save him is if he's close enough to do so. If only when we hit these spots, if only we will step out into possibility, and when we find ourselves struggling, we will call out and ask Jesus to save and to rescue us. Only when we do so can we discover that he's close enough to do it. All of the what-if questions that we have, all of the what-if fears, what if I do this and then, what if it turns into what if I do this and then, why don't we focus on the possibilities of what happens when we're invited into an adventure, even if we're in the middle of a storm? We don't put our faith in our abilities, in our strength, in our courage to muster whatever it is that we need to do the thing. We put our faith in the grace of God, which is available to us when we most need it. Save me. And Jesus does. And together, they finish the walk back to the boat. I don't know if you've thought about this very often. Oftentimes, we focus on that exchange that happens between Jesus and Peter. But they actually have some walking to do. And I can just envision Jesus with his arm around Peter as they walk together back to the boat, talking and encouraging and inspiring him to take those next steps, even after he's failed. To look at and think about what is possible when you call out to me and place your life in my hands. And so they walk back to the boat together. And as the disciples, as they get into the boat, all of a sudden, the storm stops. The wind cease, the waves cease. And the disciples who are in the boat are simply amazed. And the very first and only thing that they can actually think to do is to fall down and to worship Jesus. They say, "You really are the Son of God," as if it's the first time they've seen Jesus do something phenomenal. Which makes me think, what if when people looked at our lives, that the only response that seemed fitting was for them to fall down and worship because they had seen Jesus's saving work that he had done in our own lives? What if in the middle of a storm, as Jesus saves and delivers and takes us to new places, as people watch that and see that, that it so undoes them that all they can think to do is to worship that very same God? So I don't know. Maybe the next time you find yourself in over your head, maybe instead of freaking out and thinking about all the ways in which this thing could go wrong, Maybe you should just listen for the voice that is responding to your cry, that is closer to you than you even realize, and inviting you to come forward. There's nothing to gain as you cower in your boat. There's only something to gain if you move forward. Yeah, but what if I fail? What if this doesn't work? What if this ends in disaster? Yeah, but what if it doesn't? What if you discover something new about yourself? What if you discover something new about God? What if you experience a new adventure that you didn't even think you could learn anymore at this point in your life? Yeah, what if? The what ifs are endless. But even if we fall and fail, even if the water is over our heads, even if we are sinking, what we learn from this story is that Jesus is actually closer than we think he is, and that he's always willing and available to help us out of our latest and greatest storm. He's closer than we think. So just take a step. Take a step. Where are you being invited to move out into something new? Where in the middle of this storm that you find yourself in have you been cowering, complaining, criticizing, being negative? Where and when will it come your turn to step into something beautiful, something wonderful, something magical, something adventurous, something good, something noble, something beautiful? The invitation is there. You only have to place your faith not in your abilities and not in your courage, but in the one who is able to save you by his grace. He's closer than you think. Just take a step today and experience what he will do. Let's pray. Father, this is not only Peter's story, it is our story. And we have found ourselves in a collective storm for far longer than we have wanted to. And water has been coming over the side of our boat for a very long time, and many of us are tired. And we wonder how much longer we can last. I ask that you would give us new eyes. I ask that you would help us to see what is right in front of us, to not focus on our fears and doubts, but to focus on your invitation into a new space. On your invitation into something new and wonderful and bold. Help us to hear your voice. To stop making excuses. And to come forward into the life that you're calling us to. And as we do, may we not be surprised when people are in awe and worship the very God that they have seen do great things in and with and through our lives. In Christ we pray. Amen.